level of legislators is. But I know that it is criticized by some of the people of Alaska. And I think this is unfortunate, and it's a small detail that I think legislators have to show some restraint on. In the Constitutional Convention, I think we had no professional constitutionalizers. We had, maybe with one or two exceptions, no bums there who were there simply because they had nothing else to do during that winter of 1955-56. There may have been one or two. But most people worked very hard. And I think we came out of the Constitutional Convention with the public perception that we had done a good job and that we were sincere and conscientious in what we were doing. I think this matter of level of salaries is, of course, very much geared to the length of session. Looking over the proceedings, it seemed to be our feeling that after the first two sessions of the legislature, when most of the structure of the government, as far as statutes are concerned, would have been erected, that the legislature would go back to perhaps a session of 30 days a year. And I find this mentioned by a number of delegates who spoke on the question. The longest session that anybody could foresee, even for the first years, was a 120-day session, and that was sort of an outside figure that was mentioned by one delegate. We thought, of course, we were, as Steve says, we were reacting to an entirely different situation. We were reacting to a situation where the federal government, through the Organic Act, told our legislature how long it could meet, and it could meet only 60 days, and it could only do it every other year. And so when we thought of maybe having a session of 60 or 90 days every year, that seemed more than adequate to conduct the business of the new state. But times change. I think by and large, the legislative provision is excellent. I don't think it needs many changes. Perhaps if we could have foreseen the one man, one vote decision of the United States Supreme Court in the matter of state legislative senates as well as houses of representatives, we might have more seriously considered a unicameral body. We didn't really come close, I think, Steve, to providing for a unicameral legislature. We discussed it and we brought out the issues, but I think the decision was early made that we would have a bicameral legislature. I think the legislature in Alaska has probably done a much better job than you get credit for. And this is always the way. One of the built-in hazards of a democracy is that you're going to be anybody in public office is going to be subjected to unfair criticism. And he doesn't have too good a way of coming back and answering his detractors. So keep on doing what you're doing. We hope you will do it with a little more pinching of the pennies. We, in the Constitutional Convention, we really pinched them. And we spent very little money on our deliberations. We talked about how it would be out of the question, for instance, for the entire cost of a legislature under statehood to be as much as $600,000 for a session. We thought if anything like that was in the Constitution, it certainly would not be ratified by the people. Now, I don't know how much we're now spending for a legislative session. I'm not talking just about salaries and per diem, but all the clerk hire and the supplies and the other things that go into a legislative session. And it was said by, I have many delegates that you know saying that just could not possibly be. Ralph Rivers said, if we provided $120,000 a year for the legislature, that would be a deluxe deal and the people would turn it down. And Mildred Herman said, she said that she had had the dubious pleasure of trying to present the fiscal picture of statehood to a number of congressional committees. And In these, we used to come up with budgets where the additional cost to statehood under over-territorialism would be something like $1 million a year. And she pleaded with us in connection with the legislative salary thing, don't make me out too big a liar. Well, I hope the legislature is not making all of us out too big a liar in some of the things you're doing at the state capitol. I want to compliment you in general. These are just minor things. I do think that the matter of the image of the legislature and the perception of the legislature in the minds of the voters of Alaska is a biggie, and I hope you'll give it great thought. I'm sure you're doing that, but maybe it needs even more thought. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sundborg. The hour of 12 having arrived, unless someone insists upon...
Yes.
I thought he would. we'll close off. We have another gentleman. Mule, would you defer to the gentleman here sitting across from you? He's been waving at me a bit, and he may have something to contribute that really ought to go on the record.
My name's Don Hopkins. I will try to make it as brief as I can. We in the United States and in Alaska continually pat ourselves on the back and say we have the best government. We don't say we have the best possible government, we just say we have the best government that exists. And I think we don't have a good enough government. All of the problems that beset us nationally and in this state seem to be getting worse, and the public seems to be getting more and more discouraged with their governments nationally and locally and as at the state level. And perhaps we should take a broader look at the structure of our government, including our legislature, and see if there isn't something could be done to improve its functioning and to improve its image, as was mentioned earlier here. Now I would like to suggest, as I have a couple of times in the past, that we think seriously about a fourth branch of government. Now, as Mr. Fink mentions, the state legislature is supposed to set policy, and as others have mentioned, the governors and the bureaucrats have taken over this function. I would like to see the general policy function taken over by the voters through a formal organization consisting of many small units, well organized so that they can function together, and that this voters' branch of government would create and review each year a general policy statement on all public issues. And then it would be the function of the legislature to enact laws to carry out these general policies and the function of the executive to administer the laws. But I would like to see this general policy function returned to the voters, to the citizens. And I would appreciate any comments that members of the panel might care to make on this suggestion. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Does anyone on the panel wish to make a remark? Tom?
Well, I just got to think it's impractical. The whole concept of representative government, you spend so much time trying to have your, like you, I guess you're talking about a big town meeting that sets policy, and I just think that it practically wouldn't work unless everyone was a millionaire that could give up his job for two or three months a year. I think it's good theory, and I, you know, even today in the Anchorage area, we're trying to disperse government through community councils and all that, and you're going to end up with a bunch of special interest people who have the time to attend that kind of a meeting, as opposed to the people who you vote for making those decisions.
Mr. Hopkins, is it?
Yes.
Isn't our legislative process sufficiently clear in this sense that the part of the duty of the legislature is to hold public hearings in various areas of the state, on various types of bills. And isn't this a door to the very thing that you're talking about? You instead of setting up another branch of government, isn't it the function of the voting citizen who has a concern like yourself to be at these various public hearings and demonstrate your opinions?
That's the theory, but it doesn't seem to work too well. I have participated in a number of public hearings because that is the way it is supposed to work. Many people are discouraged from participating in public hearings because they feel their words will have no effect. And in fact, that is my observation of the case. The general public participation in public meetings has very little effect. The bureaucrats, and I've been one, go through the motions because they're supposed to, but they in general they have their minds made up ahead of time. And I suspect the legislators do too. The public senses this, and they don't participate. They don't even go out and vote. And to me, this indicates a real sickness in our system.
Redner.
Well, I think this role is being taken on somewhat, Don, by the public advocacy groups. We've seen them institutionalized, become very strong in the consumer area, the environmental area, areas of law such as ACLU. And in fact, both the Congress and state governments have given many of those groups special legal recognition in bringing third-party suits in order to police government. I'm not sure that's entirely adequate, but it is a way that we can acknowledge that often legislatures are responsive to special interests and perhaps need to encourage the outside policemen of their own system. I felt the last several legislatures actively looked for ways of supporting and encouraging those kind of functions, even though they turn around and bite us right back, is generally what happens. And I think the legislator today is beginning only now to appreciate the role of the advocate group. If we go down and talk to an environmental group, they're going to question whichever alternatives we put up. They're not going to agree with us on any one of them. I think sometimes it's us that don't understand them, not them failing to understand us. They know we're the jury. They know we have to pick between a gas line, a Devil's Canyon, mine mouth coal, or some other energy source. But they're going to make sure that we, you know, police all the alternatives before we make the decision. I think this does fill in some of that particular arena, and that's one I think a lot of us encourage.
There's a great difference between the opportunity to make a statement of advice and to make a statement of direction. And what I'm talking about is that the citizen has the power to establish general policy, not to advise on general policy, but to establish it. And then the legislature must follow these general policy statements. There's a big difference here between advice and direction in what I propose.
I would agree, but I would like to point out one frustrating area, I think, for the modern day politician that perhaps was not there 70 years ago. 70 years ago, if I represented the constituency, that constituency would have a wide uniformity of interest within it. If I came from Chicago and I represented that area in the United States Congress, I'd know exactly who most of my constituents were, what their needs were, what their interests were, probably with their ethnic background. If I went out and picked on any door and knocked on it, I would know a great deal about that person's problem. It'd be maybe a Polish factory worker. I'd know what the family's problems were, what the spouse's problems were. The constituencies and who you represented and who therefore you must advocate, Kate, was very easy to find. In the mobility of people today, that's not possible. My next door neighbors within a half a mile of me are great dissimilarity of people. It's very difficult for the, you know, politician today to form the communication links with various people who have various concerns. It's become geographically, in terms of geographic residencies, completely scattered, both in terms of basic state residency and neighborhood residency. And it's an area where I think politicians would like to find a way to make that communication, but the problem seems to be getting worse, not better.
Well, I agree with Mike, and I think that supports my argument.
Thank you. Maybe I think it now is time to ask Delegate Kilchurch to give the closing statement succinctly. Oh, well, Mr. Kilchurch, can you wait 1 second longer? Mr. Gallagher is known for his very succinct statements.
My comment really isn't to the Constitution, but the committee arrangement of the legislature, and I'd kind of like to know Mr. Fink's comment as to this, but I've felt over the years that revenue matters have got short shift because their committee that they go to is also the committee that's concerned with only the exhaust end of the equation, namely the budget. And I feel there are a whole lot of the intake matters need a full committee to review them also. There are intake matters, or revenue matters, and health and social service where you have fees and things like that. And I think those matters also need to have a greater hearing in the legislature.
Comment?
Well, of course, I think the vehicles are there to do it. I'd hate to see another committee set up. I think the 9 committees we have, we got, depends on the where the House is set up, but, you know, generally 7 to 9 members per committee, and you end up with at least 2 heavy committees, theoretically, and one, maybe some people will have a third committee. The the Finance Committee would have the time. Certainly, all revenue matters do go to the Finance Committee. If they give it a short shrift, you know, that's unfortunate. But they certainly have the obligation to review revenue measures as well as expenditure measures. I suppose that one way that bring it up to a head, of course, would be if the administration would introduce some kind of legislation that forces the Finance Committee to take, bill of nature that forces them to bring their attention to it. Mr. Gallagher, if I were on finance, if you had a problem, we'd discuss it.
I would like to review
it
by activity.
Are you suggesting a separate committee on revenue measures as opposed to? I see. And you don't think that would spread the legislators too thin, particularly look at the Senate side and the House side? Well, I don't know that there's a yes or no answer, but I feel that we have the vehicle to do it now. And I'd hate to have somebody with 3 heavy committees or not be able to limit the finance people just to 1 committee on the House side.
Mr. Bradner.
I don't know whether a separate committee would be in order. I think I'd have to agree with Tom, but I think there are certain things that can be done to require or have the executive and the legislature to participate in the statement of what your revenues are at various points, things that come before
the public. Mr. Chairman, may I just inform you that I've just heard from the Wood Center over that the soup is getting cold.
Thank you, Mr. Hilcher.
Just to wind that comment up, such as Shirley, and I'm sure you know you were familiar with the bill we attempted to pass this last year, in which the legislature, by a certain date, would make a statement of revenues available. That could then be clearly debated at an early date between the executive and the legislature, but it would be an appropriation of revenue figure, which the legislature would say, you know, we think this figure ought to be a reasonable ceiling for us to work out our priorities beneath. That kind of thing is needed.
Thank you, gentlemen. And for the really closing close, Delegate Ewell Kilcher at long last.
There would be innumerable remarks to make, but the format of these charades that we're going through these 3 days is usually such that there's not enough time for much meaningful discussion. There are 26 delegates here, and as usual, the time we are between a rock and a hard place as to time, so I don't want to impose on you. The soup is getting cold, I understand, but so I hope there may be some other time to make some general, I think, really pertinent remarks. Being a delegate and also a former legislator, I think I could contribute, but I'm one to give a compliment to my fellow delegate Sundberg's poetic language. I presume I am one of these bums that snuck into the Constitutional Convention 20 years ago. If his definition of bum should mean a person that is in total command of his time and doesn't belong to any special interest groups and has just a general interest in matters. I'm proud to be a generalist and a bum in that respect. And I reserve my further remarks, possibly, hopefully, tomorrow. And I'll go have your soup.
Thank you, Mr. Kilcher.
I just didn't have you in mind at all.
Thank you all for your attendance and participation.
Sure, go right ahead. Go right ahead. I know. Oh, dear.
Yeah, I don't know.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the session on natural resources dealing with the Article 8 of the Alaska State Constitution, which is probably the most controversial article in the Constitution and that which many people perceive the state of Alaska through, because some of the statements that are made in Article 8 in large part have determined the philosophy of the state government as it has operated. I'd like to introduce our panel today. My far left, I have Jim Hurley. Jim has serves with me on the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission, where we are, which is a creature all of its own, the only federal state organization of its particular type that is kicking around. And we get to do all sorts of fun things on there, like dealing with the national interest lands and that sort of thing. Jim is in business in Kodiak, and He's a Wasilla resident who is a businessman in Kodiak, is the best way of describing it. And Jim was a delegate at the Constitutional Convention and will open our discussion by telling us exactly how they arrived at their conclusions on the formulation of the Constitution in general and Article 8 in particular. Next to Jim is Bob Whedon. Bob is presently Professor of Wildlife Management at the University of Alaska and was the first Director of Policy Development and Planning in the Hammond administration, among his most recent accomplishments. On my immediate right is our present Commissioner of Natural Resources, Guy Martin. Next to Guy is the immediate past Commissioner of Natural Resources, Chuck Herbert. And Chuck and I are also the University of Alaska alumni on this panel. Tim, did you graduate from the university here? Anybody else? I think we're the only U of A alumni here. Jim?
You didn't graduate from the university.
No. Okay.
Berkeley, I did.
And on my far end is Tim Wallace, who is presently president of Doyon Incorporated, state legislature, and a whole host of other things. So, and for those of you who don't know me, I'm Walt Parker, and I'm presently state co-chairman of the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission. Exercising the chairman's prerogative, I'd just like to say a few brief words about natural resources from the perspective of the chair. I think in going back to the time of the Constitutional Convention and surveying the state as it was then, when things operated at a fairly low level, there wasn't really that much going on. The land, with a few small private holdings, except for a few private holdings around the cities, was all administered by BLM and not administered all that sternly, so it was available to everyone under the mining laws of 1872 or the leasing laws of 1920 governing leasable minerals. The military presence, of course, accounted for a good deal of our payroll. And as we were coming up on statehood, there was the first glimmerings of oil and gas development and all of the things that are about us now. But during those days, why, of course, fish was the big economic sector of the state, which was totally controlled by major outside corporations. By the time of the Constitutional Convention, mining economically was somewhat dormant, and there once again, there was a good deal of outside control by major corporations, a good deal of the mining land that was tied up by outside concerns. As I said before, oil and gas was just beginning to be with us. In any case, the one of the themes that was heard a great deal in Alaska in those days was exploitation by outside interests, and it was one of the things, of course, that was one of the prime impetus toward statehood, and one of those outside interests was the federal government. The Article 8, of course, dealing with natural resources, addresses itself very little to the allocation of those resources among individuals, but it does set the guidelines by which the resources are available for use by the citizens of Alaska, the land and the water resources, and also the guidelines by which the citizens of Alaska can exploit natural resources. Some of the things which have occurred since Article 8 was written, which at least from the perspective of from my perspective, are beginning to have major bearing on it, are the subsistence question, which has come up in recent years, dealing with the utilization of fish and game, which of course the Constitution is very clear on as belonging as a commonwealth to all of the state citizens, but which we've already had to write one amendment to the Constitution, which is Section 15 in Article 8, dealing with the limited entry into fisheries. Even though fish and game are still a commonwealth to all citizens, why Section 15, of course, sets some certain rules for how that commonwealth will be apportioned between the citizens. Another thing that has come up, which is the whole implication of leasing policy, which our commissioners, of course, will give a good deal of attention to. And the administration of lease policy, as it affects the whole economic future of the state. Some of the other things that were not, which were foreseen, I think, very clearly by some of the delegates, and I don't want to get too much into Jim's here, but, you know, the impact of the federal programs as those become important on the state management of resources. And these are some of the many things that have occurred. And, of course, the two major things, the very massive development of oil and gas resources and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement, cannot be ignored in any longer in any interpretation of Alaska's Constitution, especially as it affects natural resources. So with that lead in, why, Jim?
Well, I don't know what I got left to say, but I think probably every one of these sessions has been opened with a background of the thinking of the period, and I think really you do have to sort of look back and put yourself in the times that it was created. There were just, of course, we were still a territory. We were still very much under control of the federal government. And there were certain histories of things that had happened in Alaska which were paramount in the minds of the people who were concerned with the resource article. We had a history of the robber baron period, or the extraction high grading of ores and various other things, and some timber. We went then, swung around to very conservation-minded ethic, where the land was closed, almost impossible to develop. We were very conscious of being without much money or immediate opportunity to get money to become a viable state. We generally thought in terms of development as being necessary to sustain the state, and yet because of the past history, we were also conscious of the need for a conservation attitude. As a result, these two development and conservation things are continually playing back and forth. We wanted to develop. I think everybody wanted to see development. We thought this was the thing that was really going to be a good thing, settlement, extraction of the resources, and all that sort of thing. And yet at the same time, we didn't want this thing to turn into another rubber baron period. I was not a member of the Resources Committee. And I think another little background note that seems important to me is that the committee was chaired by Bo Smith from Ketchikan, who was a commercial fisherman and a person well versed in the resources of Alaska. And it also contained, besides other very competent, conscientious people, a gentleman by the name of Burke Riley. And Burke was an attorney, a very good attorney, and also very oriented towards the law of natural, affecting natural resource development and conservation. As a result, the article, it developed under those sort of parameters. The other thing I think that's important to remember is that fish, of course, were, this commercial fishing industry was an extremely important industry to Alaska. We felt that there was, we didn't know anything about oil at the time being present, and that fishing industry looked to be the one place where we could obtain some income to the state. The income mostly from fishing up to that time had been going out to the South 48. Hard rock minerals, the mining people, of course, are very knowledgeable of their field and very vociferous about what they think is right and wrong. And they were concerned about what type of entry would be allowed them, whether they would be able to continue the same way they had before. We were also circumscribed by another boundary, and that was that the statehood bill, of course, had not yet passed. And no one knew what it would be. There were a whole number of bills that had been introduced, and they differed a great deal as to what the statehood, the ultimate statehood bill would say in regard to the filing of mineral claims and the development of hard rock minerals. I think the other thing that was of importance at the time is that the two things in the resource the resource article concerned itself with were sport fishing and minerals. And I've already mentioned the mining people. Of course, Fairbanks being a mining community, the mining people did spend a lot of time with the committee and testified at considerable length, and so did the sports fishing people, sports fishing and hunting. As I recall, they were really the only two, that plus I'd say education and cities, were the really only lobby people that I can remember at the convention. And generally speaking, the people that were promoting their particular thinking on a particular subject, while the Constitutional Convention delegates certainly listened to them and paid great attention to what they said, they reacted a little bit differently than my experience ultimately was in the legislature. The legislature, you tend to really listen to lobbyists to get the best information you can about the thing, and concern yourself that maybe you might be able to work that out. I think the delegates, generally speaking, did not, that the information they got was stored in their mind in making a decision, but their decision was made completely aside from the pressures that were put on by a particular lobby. And whether that's good or was bad, that's my remembrance of it. I think the other thing, too, is that you must remember, as far as land ownership and dealing with land, that is surface rights to land, at that time, of course, the Homestead Act applied to Alaska. And not only Homestead Act, but home sites, recreation sites, as far as federal public domain was concerned, land was not hard to get. It was hard to develop, but it was not hard to file on it, at any rate. So there didn't conceive a great need at that time that land that the state might get from the as a result of the Statehood Act would be a big element in turning into private ownership. Now, of course, all those things have changed. So I don't know. That's just a little background. You asked me. Oh, the other thing I might mention too, that you have to keep in mind, is that there was a great concern at that time that they were more concerned as to the way an administrative department would supervise the particular resource than they were about what to do about protecting the resource. And this is how we got into, if you note, the Constitution contains only two what we call Section 26 boards. And that Section 26 in the executive article was put in there solely for the purpose of satisfying the education people and the fish and game people, who did not want a strong single person administering the particular department that had to do with their particular concern. I guess that's about it. You asked me, you know, remember what happened 20 years ago. I can't remember where I put my glasses this afternoon, so I think that's about all.
Well, thank you, Jim. Next, we'll have Bob Whedon.
Bob?
Thank you, Walt. I wasn't at the convention. A year later, I made my first trip to Alaska, but only to study ptarmigan. And I haven't really been in touch with the Constitutional Convention, nor the events immediately before and at statehood. So I come to the Constitution as someone trying to get from the document itself the flavor of the times. The document covers a tremendous amount of ground in a very few words. And because that's the case, the words are general. There was a tremendous attempt, I'm sure, just looking at the language, for people to boil down the results of hours and days of argument, both academic and practical and political, into a few succinct words. And as is inevitably the case, those few words often start off with an assertion of policy and then provide some way out of it. So that when you look at the document, you tend to vacillate between two approaches. One, this document really doesn't provide any guidelines, because no matter what you say about it, you could do it under the Constitution. No matter what law might be passed, it's going to be constitutional. There are enough, in the vernacular of a wildlifer, weasel words. On the other hand, you have to assume that the document was worthwhile, that people were saying something. They were reflecting something about themselves and their times. And so my approach has been to ignore, to some extent, some of the qualifying phrases and say, what is it that was the nutshell of what they felt was an appropriate natural resources policy? The Constitution very obviously shows the effects of what was, at least in the 1950s, modern times and modern thinking. I might cite, for example, the prominence of the term sustained yield as it applies to the use of renewable resources. I might cite also the limitations that were clearly spelled out on the use of surface lands by miners in pursuit of the fruits of their mineral deposit on which they held title. I might cite also the attention to free and public access to either navigable or public waters of the state. But regardless of the fact that you can find some modern concepts very clearly outlined in the natural resources article, the general flavor, at least I will argue so to maybe stimulate some thinking around the table here, the general flavor of the document is strongly that of 19th century manifest destiny. The people who wrote the Constitution were still winning the West. They were the winners of the West. They were the pioneers. And what were they winning it for? They were winning it for their idea of development, of human development. Their idea was, of course, the same idea that they had a few years before when they were living in Nebraska or New York, or their fathers and mothers were. Extremely few of the delegates to the convention had been born in Alaska. They were playing out the last round, you might say, of the winning of the West. And I mean no slur at all by this. No matter, you do live in a times, you are embedded in it, the times weave all through you. And try as you might to write for the future, you can't write forever. And I guess what's happening now is that time has speeded up somehow. A year is worth more than a year. There's an inflation of time, or maybe it's a compression of time, depending on which way you look at it. And the passage of 20 years has meant more in terms of an evolution of ideas than the passage of 20 years, let's say, a century ago. The Constitution is a document that was written by newcomers, and they were representatives of the older states' agrarian and industrial urban culture. And the document was written to serve their own concepts and specific styles of human development. I might call your attention to the preamble to the Constitution and its reference to God, to pioneers and pioneering, and to, quote, our heritage. And I think there's little doubt as to who the our is, the pronoun, in that particular case. I might note also in the Section 1, the policy statement of Article 8, the Natural Resources article, which says, in part, quote, to encourage the settlement of its land and the development of its resources. This suggests that settlement was a process newly started, or a process largely ahead of the people in Alaska. And therefore, it fails to recognize pre-white settlement, pre-white use of resources, and pre-white styles of development. And I think that this is a very considerable note as we look at the total flavor of the natural resources section and other parts of the document. Again, partly because of the tenor of the times and for reasons that Jim has explained, the natural resources article is highly materialistic and utilitarian. The language is sprinkled liberally with such words as maximum use consistent with the public interest, maximum benefit. In Section 5, we read, to assure greater utilization, development, reclamation, and settlement of lands, and to assure fuller utilization and development of the fisheries, wildlife, and waters. Section 18, which as far as I know has not been exercised yet, is a section which relates to private ways of necessity, and when you try to figure out what that means, it says that the state can use its powers of eminent domain to obtain a right-of-way for an extractor of a resource across someone else's land, which sounds like, at least to me, not being a constitutional lawyer, it sounds like getting the state in gear for the benefit of a private developer, and perhaps that's not what it means. I'll comment also that there's a slightly parochial aura to the Constitution, which reflects the separateness that Alaskans felt and still feel. You know, when you get football games a week late, you can be forgiven for feeling a little bit separate from the rest of the country. And even in those times, a good deal of antagonism, which we still feel, towards non-Alaskans, towards the feds. In Section 2, for example, we read that the state is charged with developing its resources for the maximum benefit of its people. And when we think of it, we, the people, are a part of a larger nation. Our, let's say, for a majority of us, our kin and relatives, heritage, are all behind in the other 49 states. And it really should, there really should be some counterbalancing reference, I would think, to the fact that we are a part of a nation, separate, yes, as far as any state is separate, but still charged with a responsibility for the whole as well as the responsibility for our small part. Another comment. In Article 8, the emphasis is on commodity resources, resources that you can sell for money. The amenity resources, the aesthetic resources, the intangible values of the state are relegated, insofar as they're discussed at all, to Section 7, which is entitled Special Purpose Sites. It's as though strip mining an area of land was not a special purpose. That apparently is multiple uses, probably more than one bulldozer involved. But when you talk about wildlife or recreation or parks or wilderness, those are special uses according to the Constitution. And this, I think, accounts for the persistent attempts in the past to amend the Constitution, usually not Article 8, by the way, but Article 1, the human rights section, to include some reference to the less tangible, unsalable values, if you want to call them that, of the amenity resources. I will mention just most recently House Joint Resolution 10, which was introduced in 75, and for which there was an attempt to pass it again in 76, was introduced by Clark Greening. In 1970, there was a similar amendment to Article 1, which involved the insertion of language that citizens would have an inalienable right to a healthful natural environment. Incidentally, this latter attempt in 1970 failed of passage in the Senate. Of course, the purpose of the bill was to put it on the ballot and let the people of Alaska vote. The Senate failed to gain the necessary two-thirds majority required for something to be put on as a referendum, and it failed by virtue of a certain vote in its favor being absent that day from the legislature. It was Bill Poland. And I guess I kind of expected Kay Poland to be here today. But Bill became sick at that time, and it was for that illness, I guess, that the resolution failed to pass the Senate that year. By the continued use of the terms such as maximum use and maximum benefit, and by failing to define sustained yield, the Constitution, in my opinion, encourages or at least permits playing brinkmanship with the capacities of our lands to sustain use and to sustain harvests. There is, in fact, a very, very serious gap between what the writers of the Constitution presumed was our scientific knowledge and ability and our managerial ability to control or prevent overuse and our actual present state of knowledge and control. Cite a few instances. What do you think now about our ability to control oil spills or predict the effects of oil spills now that the Coast Guard has in this last week's newspaper admitted the fact that their oil spill control technique doesn't work in Cook Inlet? How about, for example, our ability to predict timber rotation periods or to be assured of regeneration? How about our ability to estimate sustainable harvests for commercial or sport species of fish and wildlife? We can't do it. We're constantly playing brinkmanship and losing. We lose in the case of king crab. We lose in the case of northwestern Arctic caribou. How about our ability to reduce or even increase uses of wildlife in synchrony with the fluctuating resource base? How about our ability to gauge the capacity of our air to absorb pollutants? Luckily, there's a breeze blowing today. Or our waters to degrade and dispose of wastes? How about our ability to gauge the capacity of vegetation and soil to recover following disturbance? I think that there was a serious failing on the part of people who wrote the Constitution to recognize that although their charge to manage in accordance with sustained yield was an excellent, succinct statement, that it was going to be and still will be many years before the technicians, whether they are scientific or administrative, can actually carry out that charge with any sense of true control. Well, I'm not going to imply that there's a need to completely rewrite our Constitution, although I suppose that's a temptation for the brash. A few changes in wording would be extremely useful in providing a better balance of guiding instructions to the legislature and to the executive and judicial branches. The main concern, of course, of everyone focuses on the statutes passed by the legislature and the regulations promulgated by the executive branch as instruments of the Constitution. And a question which, as far as I know, is really not going to be analyzed at this meeting is whether or not the reality of those statutes and regulations reflects the ideals that it were expressed in the Constitution.
Thank you, Bob. This session runs until 5 o'clock, so everybody will have plenty of time to challenge any of the assumptions which are developed here. And certainly, Bob gave us a great deal to challenge there. Our next speaker, Tim Wallace, as president of Doyon Corporation, represents one of the leading private landowning corporations in the world, and probably as time develops will be one of the leading holders of resources, depending on what luck brings them. And Tim also, of course, is in the state legislature, has to develop the laws under which the provisions of Article 8 are carried out. So he brings a unique perspective to this. Tim?
Thank you, Will. I just might add that I will not be in the upcoming legislature. I'm not running, so I don't know about how unique my perspective is going to be. I would just say one thing is that simply in reviewing the Constitution on the section dealing with resources, there are a few items in there that would tend to lead one into discussion in terms of, I suppose, by being from a native corporation, would zero in on the wildlife aspect. However, I'd just like to say that in the whole operation in establishing policy in relating to resource, is the fact that the policies in anything that you do, regarding whether it be operating a state government or operating in private enterprise, is that policy in essence have to be broad. There are many variables that come into play in day-to-day and month-to-month and year-by-year happenings, both with perhaps some control in which the citizens and the state have over them, other by infringement, whether it be by federal government or whether it be by international happenings. And so the policies established have to be broad enough in which to take into considerations all unknown events. And I think that with words as multiple use, as established earlier, those are things that are left up into interpretations by people which pass laws, the legislators, and of course the influence that the citizens have upon their legislators, of course through the elective process. I think perhaps in cases of laws that are passed, perhaps we sit back too many times and wonder why rather than asking why and demanding accountability. And so in establishing policies, which a constitution does do, it does have to be broad. In the creating of the constitution, as mentioned by Bob, I do think that there was a perhaps in their enthusiasm and in their frustrations in trying to get statehood that perhaps an overlook, you can blame it on statesmanship or whatever, there were a number of people here living in the state prior to the Treaty of Sessions, basically the native people of Alaska, which in all respect had no inkling of what was going on in drafting a constitution. Subsistence is a word that's been tossed around considerably. There's been a number of interpretations on subsistence. And who is to say who is right on subsistence? In fact, there are many native people that perhaps could not identify subsistence, but in fact knows unto himself exactly what he would relate to subsistence. But for in terms of Webster type identification, I don't think so. And I don't think anyone has really come up with a sound policy on that, or definition of subsistence. The whole area of the fish and game is one that is, of course, controversial. There is a section in here dealing with limited entry. That, of course, is on the ballot for a deletion, deleting limited entry. Whether it's right or wrong, I don't think we'll be going into that today. So all in all, I do believe in our discussion here that the Constitution dealing with state lands and the various wording, whether we delete some wording or recommend deleting some wording or what, I think could be up for discussion. And I'm sure everybody here has their own interpretations and recommendations. So I won't go into it any further right now, Walt. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Chuck Herbert has been involved in the development of Alaska resources for some 40 years or so now, Chuck, and he's pretty well run the gamut of all phases of the mining industry, at least, and was as Commissioner of Natural Resources from 70 to 74 involved in some of the great recent decisions affecting those resources. So, Chuck, I'm sure they'll be eager to hear from what you have to say on Article 8.
No. Thank you, Walt. Since this is such a pleasant party, I might as well start out by agreeing. I find quite interested in what Bob Whedon had to say, and I wanted to pick out one particular statement that he made with which I thoroughly agree when he refers to Section 2 and objects, properly so, to the statement that the legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and waters, for the maximum benefit of its people. And he says, no, that we must be a part of the whole nation, that our resource development, if it exists and how it exists, should be for all of the people. I think that that's very important today. When this Constitution was drafted, of course, as was also mentioned by Mr. Hurley, mining was in the doldrums. There was not much mineral production, some gold trying to revive, and they were not doing very well at it. Other metals that are required, other minerals were not known. The oil had not been discovered. Consequently, the state was not an important part of the nation in supplying its material needs. And so I suppose that this little statement could go through there, and it should, that we should develop it for our own use. In other words, make a parochial stab at everything. But the time has come now when the nation is going to depend upon this state, this great area, for its material needs. Now, you can say that you can substitute the aesthetic values for material needs, but you can only do it so far. And we are going to have to look at the broader picture. The oil that is being developed here, of course, is going to be shipped outside. There's no way that we could ever use it. It's going to happen to all of our minerals up here, and we must look upon our development as being a part of the nation that has supported us for so long in the past. So I thoroughly agree with Bob, if that's what he meant. I'm not too sure.
I hate it when you agree with me.
I might just point out a rather interesting thing. I was looking over some old notes the other day, and I picked up something that former Secretary of the Interior Roger C. Morton said in one of his messages to the Congress. I'm not always sure that he read his own messages, but this one referred to the widening gap in the United States mineral deficit, that is, the difference between what we can export in minerals or products made from minerals to what we import. And he shouted a great warning. He said that by 1985, that deficit might be $30 billion per year. And he thought that was a horrendous thing with which we could not live. Just recently, the Bureau of Mines drew up its estimate for the current year, and they show a mineral deficit in 1976, 9 years earlier, of $29 billion. Consequently, this state must look to its importance in the nation